A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about air superiority, specifically in the context of Israel's operations against Iran. The core question is, what does it actually take, in concrete terms, for an attacking air force to achieve air superiority? At what point does the attacking force feel confident it owns the sky? And once you've degraded an air defense system like Iran's, how fast can the other side start patching things back together? It's a practical, nuts-and-bolts question, and I think the answer is more layered than most people assume.
It absolutely is. And the first thing to understand is that air superiority isn't a single moment where someone flips a switch and the sky belongs to you. It's a condition that exists on a spectrum, and it's always temporary. The official NATO definition is that degree of air superiority wherein the opposing air force is incapable of effective interference. Note the word degree. It's not binary.
You can have 60% air superiority.
You can, and often do. The U.S. Air Force actually breaks this into three tiers. Air parity is the baseline. Neither side has a clear advantage. Air superiority is when you can conduct operations without prohibitive interference from the adversary's air and air defense forces. Then there's air supremacy, which is the absolute extreme. The other side cannot interfere at all, period. That's what the U.S. achieved in the Gulf War after the first 72 hours, and it's vanishingly rare.
I'm guessing air supremacy is the military equivalent of a perfect credit score. Everyone wants it, almost nobody has it, and the people who claim they do are probably lying.
Even during the 2003 invasion of Iraq, when the U.S. had total dominance, a few Iraqi surface-to-air missiles still got launched. So the question of, when do you feel confident? Confidence is a function of what you're trying to do. If you need to run a strike package of 20 aircraft against a single target deep in enemy territory, the threshold for good enough air superiority is different than if you're trying to maintain a no-fly zone for 6 months.
Let's ground this in the Iran situation. Walk me through what Israel actually had to do, operationally, to get to the point where they could operate over Iranian airspace with acceptable risk.
There's a framework that defense analysts use, and it breaks the problem into four buckets. First, you have to suppress or destroy the enemy's integrated air defense system, what they call IADS. Second, you have to neutralize their air force, their fighter jets, either in the air or on the ground. Third, you have to establish command and control dominance, which includes things like jamming their radars and disrupting their communications. And fourth, you have to sustain all of this over time, because air superiority decays the moment you stop actively enforcing it.
Let's take those one at a time, because I think the IAD's piece alone is worth half the episode. What actually makes up an integrated air defense system?
An IADS is a layered network. At the top, you've got early warning radars, long-range systems that can detect aircraft hundreds of miles away. Then you've got acquisition and tracking radars that feed data to surface-to-air missile batteries. Those missile batteries come in layers too. Long-range systems like the S-300, medium-range like the S-200 or the US Hawk system, and short-range point defense like the Russian Tor or Pantsir. Then below that, you've got man-portable air defense systems, man-pads, and anti-aircraft artillery. All of this is tied together by command and control nodes, fiber optic cables, radio links, and often a centralized operations center.
It's not just a bunch of missile launchers scattered around. It's a nervous system.
It's exactly a nervous system, and that's the key insight for how you defeat it. You don't need to kill every single missile launcher. You need to blind the eyes, sever the nerves, and paralyze the brain. Once the system can't coordinate, individual batteries become dramatically less effective, even if they're still physically intact.
Because a radar that isn't networked is just a guy with a flashlight.
And that's where Israel's approach to Iran has been particularly instructive. There was a really detailed piece in the War Zone, TWZ, analyzing the Israeli strikes from earlier in this conflict. They didn't just bomb missile sites. they systematically went after the command and control infrastructure. The operation centers, the communication hubs, the hardened bunkers where the air defense commanders coordinate their response. When you take those out, the individual batteries are reduced to operating on their own initiative, which is vastly less effective against a coordinated strike package.
Iran's IADS. How sophisticated are we actually talking? Because the popular narrative is that they've got Russian hardware and some indigenous copies, but it's not exactly Moscow's finest.
Iran's air defense network is a patchwork. They've got a handful of S-300 PMU-2 systems they received from Russia. Those are genuinely capable long-range systems. They've got older S-200s, some domestically produced systems like the Bavar 373 and the Khordad series, and then a lot of point defense systems. The real limitation isn't the hardware per se, it's that their network isn't as tightly integrated as what you'd see in a NATO country. They have gaps in radar coverage, their systems from different eras don't always talk to each other smoothly, and their command and control doctrine is more centralized and brittle.
Brittle meaning what?
Meaning if you take out the central node, the whole thing degrades disproportionately. A more distributed, resilient network, like what the US has built, can lose nodes and keep functioning. Iran's system is more hub and spoke. You knock out the hub, and suddenly everyone's on their own.
That's the first bucket. What about the second one, neutralizing their air force?
This is where the Iranian situation is actually unusual. Iran's air force is not the primary threat. Their most modern fighter is the MiG-29 from the early 90s, and they've got some F-14 Tomcats from the Shah era that they keep flying through sheer mechanical ingenuity and parts cannibalization. Against a modern air force like Israel's with F-35s and F-15s, those aircraft are not winning dogfights, so the air-to-air threat from Iranian fighters is real but limited.
The air force piece is almost secondary to the missile threat.
And that's the third bucket, command and control dominance, which loops back into what we were saying about the IADS. But there's a separate dimension here that's worth pulling out, which is the offensive counter-air mission. That's when you destroy enemy aircraft on the ground before they can even take off. Israel has historically excelled at this. Operation Focus in 1967 is the textbook example, where they destroyed the Egyptian Air Force on the ground in the opening hours of the Six-Day War.
Against Iran, is that even a relevant play? Their airfields are farther away. Their aircraft are dispersed.
It's relevant, but harder. Iran has dozens of airfields. Their aircraft are indeed dispersed and often hardened in shelters, and the distances involved mean Israel's strike packages have to travel a long way, which gives warning time. But that's where the precision munitions come in. A single joint direct attack munition or a spice-guided bomb can destroy a hardened aircraft shelter. So the math changes. You don't need a huge number of sorties to neutralize a dispersed air force if every sortie can kill multiple targets with high confidence.
The fourth bucket, sustaining it. This is where I think Daniel's question gets really interesting. How fast can Iran patch things up?
This is the question that keeps air campaign planners up at night. The degradation timeline and the reconstitution timeline are two different curves, and the gap between them is where you operate.
Paint me those curves. You've just hit their IADS. What happens in the first 24 hours?
In the first 24 hours, chaos. The centralized command and control is down. Individual battery commanders are trying to figure out what's happening, what's still operational, what orders they should be following. Radars that survived are going passive to avoid being targeted. Communication is fragmented. This is the window where an attacking air force has maximum freedom of action.
The golden hours. The golden hours.
Day 2 through day 5, you start to see the adversary adapt. They'll bring mobile radars out of hiding, reposition surviving missile batteries, establish ad hoc communication links, sometimes literally using civilian cell networks or couriers on motorcycles. It's not elegant, but it starts to restore some capability. By day 7 to 10, if they haven't been hit again, they can reconstitute a meaningful, if degraded, air defense picture.
What does meaningful but degraded look like in practical terms?
Instead of a seamless radar picture across the country, they might have coverage over 60% of their territory, with gaps that an attacker can exploit. Instead of coordinated multi-battery engagements, where three different missile systems are all guiding on the same target, you get single battery engagements that are much easier to evade or jam. Instead of centralized target prioritization, you get local commanders making their own calls, which leads to inefficient allocation of missiles.
The attacker's job in the sustainment phase is basically to keep kicking them back down the curve every time they start climbing back up.
That's it. And this is where the tempo of operations becomes everything. If you strike once and then pause for 3 weeks, you're essentially gifting them a reconstitution window. The most effective air superiority campaigns maintain persistent pressure, not necessarily round-the-clock bombing, but regular strikes that remind the adversary that if they turn on a radar, it's going to get hit. That creates a psychological dimension where air defense operators become hesitant to emit, which is itself a form of suppression.
Suppression without destruction.
The technical term is SEED, suppression of enemy air defenses versus DEA'd, destruction of enemy air defenses. SEED is about making them afraid to use their systems. DEAD is about physically eliminating them. A good campaign uses both, but SEED is often more cost-effective because you can achieve it with electronic warfare, decoys, and the mere credible threat of a strike.
Iran's specific vulnerabilities here. I've seen reporting that their long-range ballistic missile threat was significantly blunted by Israeli strikes. How does that connect to the air superiority question?
There was a breaking defense piece on exactly this, the left-of-boom approach. The Israeli strikes didn't just go after air defense sites. They went after Iran's offensive missile capability, the ballistic missile production facilities, the launch infrastructure, the storage sites. And that's actually integral to achieving air superiority in this context, because Iran's primary way of contesting Israeli air operations isn't with fighter jets. It's with ballistic missiles launched at Israeli air bases.
If you're Israel, air superiority over Iran also means making sure they can't lob a barrage of Shahab missiles at your airfields while your jets are refueling.
Air superiority isn't just about what happens in the air over the target area. It extends backward to your own bases. If the adversary can disrupt your sortie generation by hitting your runways, your fuel depots, your munition storage, then you don't have air superiority even if your jets are untouchable in the sky. It's a systems problem.
That's a point I think most public discussion misses entirely. People imagine air superiority as two air forces dueling in the clouds, but it's really about the entire kill chain from base to target and back.
That's why the integrated air defense is so important, and why breaking that integration is the attacker's primary lever. Let me give you a concrete example. When Israel struck Iranian air defense sites in earlier rounds, reporting indicated they specifically targeted the fiber optic nodes that connected radar sites in western Iran to the central command in Tehran. Once those were severed, the radars in the west were still physically capable of detecting aircraft, but the data wasn't reaching anyone who could act on it.
It's like having a security camera system where the cameras still work, but the monitor in the guard's office is black.
And that guard is now relying on a phone call from someone who heard something, which is not a great air defense posture.
Let's talk about the confidence question. At what point does an Israeli mission planner look at the intelligence picture and say, okay, we can operate with acceptable risk?
This is where the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance piece becomes critical. You're never going to get 100% certainty. What you're looking for is a few specific indicators. First, are the enemy's long-range early warning radars offline or suppressed? If those are still operating, they can cue fighters and longer-range SAMs, and your window of surprise shrinks dramatically.
That's indicator one. Are the big eyes closed?
Indicator two, have you degraded their ability to guide missiles onto targets? This is different from just destroying launchers. A surface-to-air missile needs a fire control radar to illuminate the target, especially for semi-active radar homing missiles. If you've taken out or suppressed the fire control radars, the missiles are just expensive fireworks. Have you established electronic warfare dominance? Can you jam their surviving radars, spoof their communications, and operate your own sensors without being effectively countered? Electronic warfare is the invisible dimension of air superiority, and it's arguably more important than the kinetic strikes. Have you neutralized their ability to threaten your bases? That's the ballistic missile and drone piece. If the adversary can still launch salvos at your airfields, you might have local air superiority over their territory, but you don't have operational air superiority, because your ability to sustain operations is compromised.
It's not one threshold, it's a checklist, and you can have partial air superiority, enough to do some missions, but not others.
And that's where the operational art comes in. A mission planner might assess that they have sufficient air superiority to run a standoff strike, firing long-range munitions from outside the reach of surviving air defenses, but not sufficient to send a strike package directly over Tehran. The risk calculus is granular and mission-specific.
Now let's flip it around. Iran's perspective. Their air defense network has been hit. What does their reconstitution process actually look like? Not the theoretical version, the practical, we've got a problem and limited resources version.
The first thing they do is a damage assessment, which is harder than it sounds when your command and control is degraded. They're sending people out to physically inspect sites, which takes time. Then they triage. Fixed radars that are destroyed are not coming back quickly. Those are large, complex installations. But mobile systems that survived can be repositioned to cover critical gaps.
What's the timeline on a fixed radar installation? If you crater one with a 2,000-pound bomb, how long until it's back online?
For a major long-range radar like the ones Iran operates, you're looking at months at minimum, and potentially never if the specialized components are hard to source. These aren't off-the-shelf items. The antenna arrays, the signal processing units, the cooling systems, much of this is either imported or requires specialized manufacturing. If the site is completely destroyed, the realistic timeline to rebuild from scratch is 6 to 18 months, assuming they can get the necessary components.
Which, under sanctions, is not exactly a trip to the electronics store.
Iran's defense industry has gotten quite good at indigenizing certain capabilities. They've reverse-engineered missile components, they produce their own radars, but the quality and performance often lag behind what they can import. So there's a trade-off: they can reconstitute faster with lower-quality indigenous replacements, or wait longer for higher-quality imported systems.
The mobile systems. Those are presumably harder to find and kill in the first place, but also more limited in capability.
A mobile system like the S-300's engagement radar on a truck can be hidden in a warehouse, moved at night, and popped up only when needed. But it can't cover the same volume of airspace as a fixed long-range radar. So you end up with a reconstituted air defense picture that's patchy, strong in some spots, completely absent in others. And the attacker's ISR is constantly mapping those patches.
ISR being intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance.
Modern ISR is relentless. Drones, satellites, signals intelligence. They're constantly sniffing for radar emissions, tracking where mobile systems are moving, mapping the gaps. So the attacker knows almost in real time where the reconstituted coverage is and isn't.
Which leads to a cat-and-mouse dynamic that never really ends.
It's a continuous cycle, and this is why the sustainment phase of an air superiority campaign is so resource-intensive. You can't just declare victory and go home. You have to keep striking, keep jamming, keep mapping, keep suppressing. The moment you ease off, the reconstitution curve starts climbing.
There's something almost thermodynamic about this. Air superiority is like a hot object in a cold room. It's constantly cooling off unless you keep adding energy.
The rate of cooling depends on the adversary's resilience. Iran's air defense force has shown a fair amount of adaptability. After previous Israeli strikes, they were observed repositioning surviving systems within 48 hours, establishing backup communication links, and even using decoys, inflatable or mock radars, to draw fire.
Decoys are a whole fascinating subtopic. How effective are they actually?
More effective than you'd think because of the fundamental challenge of battle damage assessment. If you're looking at satellite imagery and you see a radar-shaped object that's been blown up, confirming whether it was real or a decoy requires additional intelligence, signals intelligence to confirm it was emitting, or human intelligence on the ground. In the fog of an ongoing campaign, decoys absolutely absorb strikes that would otherwise hit real systems.
They're buying time as much as anything.
They're buying time and preserving real capability. Every munition that hits a decoy is a munition that didn't hit an actual radar. And in a campaign where the attacker has a finite number of precision munitions, which everyone does, that matters.
Let's zoom out a bit. The prompt mentions that Israel has achieved air superiority over Iran on multiple occasions. Is that actually the right framing? Are we talking about sustained air superiority or episodic windows of superiority during specific strike campaigns?
That's a crucial distinction. What Israel has achieved in these rounds of conflict is episodic, localized air superiority, Superiority over specific target areas for specific time windows enabled by comprehensive suppression strikes at the outset of each campaign. They are not maintaining continuous air superiority over Iranian airspace. That would require a persistent presence of combat air patrols, continuous electronic warfare, ongoing strikes. It would be astronomically expensive.
It's more like they're creating temporary bubbles of superiority.
The bubble forms around the strike package. It's created by a combination of pre-strike suppression, escort jamming, and the threat of follow-up strikes on anything that emits. The bubble lasts long enough for the mission to be completed, and then it dissipates.
Between campaigns, Iran reconstitutes, which is why we keep having new rounds.
That's the strategic rhythm. Attacker strikes, defender degrades. Attacker pauses, defender reconstitutes. Attacker strikes again, and the cycle repeats. The question is whether the reconstitution is keeping pace with the degradation, or whether each cycle leaves the defender permanently weaker.
From what I've read, Iran's air defense capability has taken a significant net loss across these rounds. The systems they're reconstituting are fewer and less capable than what they started with.
That's the assessment from multiple analysts. The combination of precision strikes on fixed infrastructure, attrition to mobile systems, and the difficulty of importing replacements under sanctions means Iran's air defense network is almost certainly less capable now than it was 2 years ago. But less capable is not the same as incapable. And there's always the wild card of new foreign assistance. If Russia or China were to supply advanced systems, the reconstitution timeline could accelerate dramatically.
That's a geopolitical variable the mission planners have to account for, but can't control.
And speaking of things mission planners have to account for, let's talk about the human factor. Air defense operators are people. They get tired, they get scared, they make mistakes. After a sustained suppression campaign, the psychological toll is real. If every time you turn on your radar, something bad happens, you start to become very conservative about turning on your radar.
That's the SEAD effect you mentioned earlier. Suppression without destruction. But it's not just a technical phenomenon. It's a human one.
And it's cumulative. The longer a suppression campaign runs, the more cautious the adversary's operators become. There are historical examples from the Balkans and Iraq where air defense operators essentially stopped emitting entirely because the risk-reward calculation didn't make sense. Why turn on your radar to maybe get a shot at one aircraft if turning it on means a HARM anti-radiation missile is going to arrive at your position in under a minute?
HARM being the high-speed anti-radiation missile. It hones in on radar emissions.
And modern variants are extremely fast and extremely accurate. The timeline from radar emits to missile arrives can be under 60 seconds. That's a very strong incentive to keep your radar off.
Let's synthesize this. The prompt asks what has to be done in concrete terms. From what we've laid out, it seems like the recipe has about 6 ingredients.
Let's hear it.
1. Blind the early warning network. Take out the long-range radars and their communication links. 2. Decapitate the command and control. Hit the operation centers, sever the fiber, jam the radios. 3. Suppress or destroy the fire control radars that actually guide missiles to targets. 4. Neutralize the offensive threat to your own bases. Ballistic missiles, drones, anything that can disrupt your sortie generation. 5. Establish persistent ISR so you know in real time what's surviving and where it's moving. And 6. Maintain tempo so the adversary never gets a clean reconstitution window.
That's a solid framework. I'd add a 7th, electronic warfare dominance across the electromagnetic spectrum. Jamming, spoofing, decoys, and signals intelligence. The invisible layer is what makes everything else work.
If you get all 7, you've got air superiority.
You've got a window of air superiority. And the size of that window depends on how thoroughly you executed each ingredient and how resilient the adversary is. Against a peer adversary like Russia or China, the window might be very narrow and the cost of creating it extremely high. Against a less capable but still formidable adversary like Iran, the window is wider, but it's never permanent.
Which brings us to the final part of the prompt, the maintenance question. Once you've got superiority, how do you keep it? And what does Iran's patching process look like practically?
Maintenance is about 3 things: persistence, intelligence, and readiness. Persistence means keeping some level of pressure on continuously. Not necessarily daily strikes, but regular enough that the adversary can't assume a pause, means safety. Intelligence means watching the reconstitution in real time and knowing when to strike again. Readiness means having the assets, aircraft, munitions, electronic warfare platforms, ready to go when the intelligence says it's time.
Iran's patching process.
It's triage, improvisation, and substitution. Triage, figure out what's still alive and what's worth saving. Improvisation, establish backup communications, reroute data through surviving nodes, reposition mobile assets. Substitution, replace destroyed high-end systems with lower capability indigenous ones, fill radar coverage gaps with point defense systems that were designed for shorter ranges. It's not elegant, but it can restore a baseline level of air defense surprisingly quickly, within a week or two for a partial picture, though a full reconstitution to pre-strike capability is a multi-month or multi-year project.
I saw an Al Jazeera piece that touched on this, analyzing how Iran has managed to occasionally pierce through Israeli air defenses, despite the degradation. The answer seems to be volume and unpredictability. Even a degraded system can get lucky if it launches enough missiles.
That's the saturation problem. Air defense is never hermetic. No system is. If you launch a large enough salvo from enough different directions, some percentage will get through. That's not a failure of air superiority per se. It's a recognition that air superiority is about reducing the adversary's effectiveness to an acceptable level, not eliminating it entirely.
Acceptable level? Doing a lot of work there. Acceptable to whom?
All of them, and they all have different thresholds. The military's definition of acceptable risk might be a 5% probability of losing an aircraft on a given mission. The public's definition of acceptable might be no missiles landing in my neighborhood. Those are very different standards, and part of the art of air campaign planning is managing those expectations.
Air superiority is partly a technical military condition, and partly a political narrative.
Every air campaign in history has had to navigate that tension. Israel's operations against Iran are no different.
One more angle before we start wrapping up. The prompt mentions that Iran's air defenses may not be the most sophisticated in the world, but overcoming them isn't a small feat. What's the hardest part, specifically? What's the thing that makes it difficult, even against a second-tier IADS?
The hardest part is the sheer complexity of coordinating everything. A modern strike package against a defended target isn't just a bunch of jets flying in. You've got the strike aircraft themselves, you've got escort fighters for air-to-air protection, you've got electronic warfare aircraft for jamming, you've got seed aircraft specifically hunting SAMs, you've got tankers for refueling, you've got ISR platforms feeding real-time intelligence, you've got command and control aircraft orchestrating the whole thing. All of this has to happen in precise sequence, often at night. Often with communications restricted for emissions control, and the adversary is actively trying to disrupt every part of it.
It's like conducting an orchestra where half the musicians can't hear each other, and someone keeps setting off fire alarms.
The fire alarms are actual missiles, so the fact that Israel has pulled this off repeatedly, against a country as large as Iran, at the operational distances involved, it's impressive. The distances alone are significant. We're talking about strike packages traveling over 1,000 miles, requiring multiple aerial refuelings, coordinating across multiple countries' airspace, and still arriving on target with precision.
That's a logistical achievement before you even get to the shooting part.
Logistics is the unglamorous foundation of air superiority. You can have the best pilots and the best jets in the world, but if you can't get them to the target area with enough fuel and munitions, you don't have air superiority. The U.S. Air Force has a saying, amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics.
Which is probably the most military thing ever said.
It really is.
To bring this full circle, air superiority against a country like Iran requires blinding, decapitating, suppressing, and sustaining. It's never absolute, it's never permanent, and it's always a race between your ability to keep the pressure on and their ability to patch things back together. The attacker has the initiative, but the defender has the home field, and the gap between those two is where the outcome is decided.
That's a good summary. And the one thing I'd add is that the reconstitution question, how fast can they patch, is ultimately a question about industrial capacity and supply chains. A country that can manufacture its own radars and missiles can reconstitute faster than one that depends on imports. Iran is somewhere in the middle. They built an indigenous defense industry, but it has real limitations. The systems they produce domestically are less capable than what they could import, and they're still dependent on foreign components for some subsystems.
The degradation might be semi-permanent for the high-end stuff, but the mid-tier and low-tier systems keep coming back.
That's the pattern we've seen. And it means that each round of strikes probably achieves diminishing returns. The first round does the most damage, and subsequent rounds are mopping up what's left and preventing reconstitution, rather than achieving the same dramatic degradation as the opening salvos.
Which is why the sustainment phase is such a grind. The exciting part is over, but the work of actually maintaining air superiority is just beginning.
That's the part that doesn't make the headlines. Everyone covers the first night of strikes. Nobody covers the 107th day of suppression patrols.
The glockenspiel of air superiority. Flashy at first, then just repetitive maintenance.
I don't know if that metaphor fully lands, but I appreciate the effort.
You're just not ready for it.
I'm never ready for your metaphors.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, salt traders crossing the African Sahel would sometimes dye their salt slabs with indigo to mark ownership. The blue pigment was so valuable that counterfeiters would paint ordinary rocks with cheap dye and try to pass them off as premium salt from the Tau Deni mines.
Salt counterfeiting with indigo dye. That's a whole black market I never knew existed.
The Sahel really had it all. To close out, the open question this leaves me with is whether the air superiority playbook that works against Iran is transferable. If a major power found itself needing to achieve air superiority against a near peer with a truly modern IADS, layered, redundant, networked, with capable fighters and electronic warfare of its own, how much of this recipe still applies? Feels like the question that keeps air campaign planners staring at the ceiling at night.
It's the question, and the uncomfortable answer is that against a near peer, the cost of achieving air superiority might be so high that you never truly achieve it. You might be fighting for air parity the entire time, and that changes everything about how you wage a war.
Something to chew on. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by the ever-mysterious Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back soon.
I'll see you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.